The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
How's the audio? Okay. Great. The topic for the talk tonight is, it's called The Coral at Kosambi. It's one of these ancient stories that can tell us something about conflict and communal and social harmony. First thing I'd like to do is, if you're willing, if you can draw to mind someone in your community, in your circles, who you think of as someone who is both effective and their actions tend to yield harmony in the community. If you can think of someone specific and draw them up in your mind. Got someone? All right. And then also, if you're willing, if with a word or a phrase, some quality or skill that they have that tends to, that you would say characterizes their ability to bring forward harmony in the community. And I'll just repeat it back so we don't need the microphone passing around. Just popcorn.
Just showing up.
Yeah.
Joy.
Great.
Patience.
Reaching out.
Acceptance.
Self-care.
Right speech.
Non-threatening.
Generosity. Great. Maybe one more?
Compassion.
Mm. That's whoever you have in mind. That's an inspiring community. Thank you. Thank you for sharing those. So in some ways, this is a talk that I've really wanted to give all week. These last few weeks, I've been studying the Buddha's teaching on social and communal harmony, and we did a series about that in 7 a.m. last week. So I want to go through these two stories in light of that set of teachings. And first, I want to give you some of the background that I pulled out from Bhikkhu Bodhi's beautiful book, The Buddha's Teachings on Social and Communal Harmony. Just a few principles we want to talk about first, and then we'll get into the stories. And the first is right view. Right view as the forerunner of social and communal harmony. Pretty easy to understand how if we can't see out the windshield, our tendency to bump into things is significantly higher. But a clear seeing, right view, wise view allows us to navigate in a way that's hopefully doing less harm for others. In the teachings, it said that the right view, it's compared to how the dawn leads. It's the dawn is the forerunner of the risen sun. It's a familiar image. It said that right view is the forerunner to all the wholesome qualities, including the Noble Eightfold Path. So right view starts us off. A little disambiguation, an important point that right view has much to do with a way of seeing, a way of relating to our experience, more so than having the right view or the right opinion about something. Does that make sense? the essentials there of right view in this context, it's two things. One is that our actions have consequences. Our actions are effective in the world. They bear fruit. And the second is that we can tell the difference in some measure between an action that's helpful and an action that's harmful. So I think when we call to mind this person and think of how they tend to nourish community, that's that right view instinct that we're tapping into. This is a person with a perspective and a way of being in the world that brings help, not hurt. Doesn't bring affliction, they bring well-being. So right view at the beginning. Second is the quality of reflection before, during, and after an action, and how we grow through our experience. I don't know if any of us in this room have ever made a mistake today. But the Buddha held in very high regard this willingness to reflect on our actions in such a way that we can kind of get a sense, oh, did I hurt someone here? Did I harm someone here? Or did I do something wholesome? And when you do something wholesome, like, rejoice. Rejoice in it. Let it grow. So right view and reflection. And at some point, it's bound to happen that if we're living a reflective life, that the habits of our character may become apparent to us. And this might show up in challenging ways, it might show up in really supportive ways. A good example of this is living a reflective life and discovering for the first time that there's anger in there. And wow, I really see a difference when that's the basis of my action. Or hostility, or cruelty. When I act from that place, is there a tendency to help or to harm? So we come into contact with these habits of our character, and then that gets to be what we reflect on. So the fourth sort of thing that we'll draw out from these stories is the power of good friendship, good Dharma friendship. And the fifth is the importance of a clarity of aspiration, I'll say. Or why is it that we do this? Why do we put ourselves... Ajahn Chah has this... he's talking about a different point, but this is the whole point of why we put ourselves through all this difficult practice. Which I appreciate from someone who was a monk for so long. You know, the practice is not easy, so why do we do it? So we'll pull out some of these things as we go through the stories. So the quarrel at Kosambi, this reveals to me, one of the reasons I love this story is that it reveals to me the Buddha as a human who dealt with difficulty in much the same way we deal with difficulty, and actually gets to the point where he walks away from a conflict, realizes that in this moment it can't be resolved. And when I saw that for the first time, I was actually really touched. So how do we get there? The way the story goes, and this comes from a couple of different places. One is the Vinaya. And apparently the backstory is that there was some, in the community of monks, there was some minor infraction. Somebody made a very small mistake. And there was a disagreement about whether or not it was actually a mistake. So even the person changed his mind a couple of times. First he was like, oh, you know, that was kind of an error. And everyone else said, oh, that's not a problem. And then he switched and was like, you know, I really think I made a mistake. I did not make a mistake there. And everyone else was on the other side. So the way that the monastic sangha creates harmony again, if there's a sort of offense, let's say, is that there's one of the ways is by way of confession. You sort of lay it out there for your friends in the holy life, they say, and then that is accepted. It's pretty simple. And then you resolve to restrain yourself in the future. So there's this minor infraction, and then there's a split. Because he's now saying, no, I didn't do anything wrong. And they're saying, oh, yes, actually, all of us agree that you did. So please. But he really knew his stuff and could make a good argument for himself. He wouldn't accept this. So not only does he not accept that he made a mistake, he decides that the thing to do is to rally a party on his behalf. So he's going to like drum up some help to get people on his side, make a good argument. Doesn't this sound familiar? You know, like make a mistake, I'm going to deny it, and then I'm going to get a whole bunch of allies. You know, it's very human. So he goes about doing this, and the split just gets bigger and bigger. So there's a certain monk who must have realized that we need a little help here. This is getting out of hand. Goes and tells the Buddha. And the monk says something like, please, out of compassion for the community, come talk to these monks. So the Buddha comes and speaks to them out of concern for the harm that can be done when the monastic community is split. So this is a really big issue. When the Buddha's thinking about the longevity of his teaching, one of the things that ensures its longevity is a united community to carry on the teaching generation after generation. And if they split, then all sorts of things can happen. So he hears about this. He's thinking, oh, the Sangha of monks is splitting. How's he going to handle this? So he doesn't talk to everyone all at once, apparently. First he goes to the offending monk and tries to reason with this monk, saying things more or less like, if someone has done an offense, someone's made a mistake, but they have the thought, I have not made a mistake, that should not be grounds for them not confessing and repairing. He's like trying to reason with this person on one side, and then he goes and tries to reason with the others. Doesn't work. He leaves for a while, and then he gets another report. Another one comes and says this. Another monk comes and says to the Buddha, now the monks are quarreling, arguing and disputing, wounding one another with verbal daggers. It would be good if the Blessed One would go out of sympathy. So things are really heating up. And the Buddha sits with the whole community this time, and he says very plainly, four phrases, don't argue, don't quarrel, don't make strife, don't dispute. And then a monk stands up and says what, on first reading, I thought was kind of a compassionate thing to say. He says, more or less, oh, Buddha, please don't worry about this. You go be comfortable, and we'll settle this ourselves. The Buddha repeats his admonition, gets the same response. And then there's a third round. And here's a moment when the Buddha became profoundly human. After the third denial, this monk saying, oh, please, don't worry about this. Please be at peace. He says it in a really nice way. And then the Buddha thinks. Here, this is a direct quote. I won't soften it. These worthless men seem to be out of control. They're not easy to convince. And he got up from his seat and left. And that was kind of stunning to me, to see or hear the Buddha get up. And reading around in some other texts, the notion that I have is that he recognized that despite his skill, it was not the time that anyone could be shifted from unwholesomeness to wholesomeness. He realized he would just be wasting his time at the moment. So what does he do? Frustrated. Well, he goes for alms. And then at the end of his alms round, he has his meal. He utters some just devastating stanzas about how people can be with each other when they're quarreling. Some of them are straight out of the Dhammapada. And then he goes and he spends time alone. He spends a lot of time alone. Makes friends with a big elephant, which is very, very cool. And then he arrives. He goes around visiting some other monks. There's one living alone, and he kind of checks in on him. And then he goes to this other scene, which is like the second story I want to tell you. But before we get there, because the scene is such a strong contrast to where we've been, just pausing for a moment and kind of registering how you are, considering the sort of conflict and quarrel that we're talking about, how that's relevant or how that lives in your lives. And taking a moment to register how in that community, this dispute going on, the absence of right view, the sort of short-sightedness of, or the lack of the reflective life. It seems like right now in the midst of the quarrel, the blinders are on, such that the most important thing is being right rather than being free. Yeah. So we're about to see something very different. What I'm going to read you is one of the sweetest things in the Vinaya. It's these three monks. I believe that the most senior of them is Venerable Anuruddha, and they're in this place called the Eastern Bamboo Park. So the Buddha's approaching. And this is an interesting detail. A park warden, apparently someone taking care of the monastery, saw the Buddha coming, and on seeing him said, "Oh, please, contemplative, don't enter the park. There are three people in here practicing, and don't bother them." which is also, this is a moment of the Buddha being profoundly human. Because there's not a sign on him that says, "I am unsurpassed, worthy one." He looks like an ascetic. He's bald head, wears a robe. And actually, I think it's looking at this another way, I really appreciate that this person called the park warden is protecting the seclusion of these practitioners. I think that's very cool. So luckily, Venerable Anuruddha overhears this, says, "Oh, it's okay, park warden. This is the Buddha, please. He's our teacher." Comes in, they pay respects. And the first thing that the Buddha says, he calls them all, the three of them, Anuruddhas. They all share the one name. He says Anuruddha in plural to refer to this group of monks. And right away, I get a little touch of how this group is living harmoniously. And he says a couple of initial things, checking in on them. Is your life tolerable? Is alms round going okay? And then he says this really sweet thing. Are you living harmoniously, cordially, and without dispute? blending like milk and water, looking at one another with eyes of affection. Elsewhere it said, looking at each other with kindly eyes. And the monks say, yes, yes, we are living this way. Not content with that, and maybe for our benefit, the Buddha goes on to say, oh, well, how are you living this way? How are you being harmonious? And again, just as you're hearing what this part of the story, the contrast of what we were just going through. And Anuruddha responds, here the thought occurs to me regarding his friends in the park. It is a gain for me, a great gain, that I'm living with companions of this sort. I am set on bodily acts of loving kindness with regard to these, to their faces and behind their backs. I really appreciate that. He goes on, I'm set on bodily, verbal, and mental acts of loving kindness. And then in this gesture of totally not clinging to any view, he says, why don't I, having put aside my own thoughts, conduct myself in line with the thoughts of these venerable ones? And then I do. And he closes by saying, our bodies are separate, Bhante, but we are one, as it were, in mind. And then the other two repeat the same thing, word for word. It's just such a kind way to regard. There's so much respect. Cordiality. This next line took me some time to really consider. So what's going on here? I would have thought that's the end of the story. So are you living well together? Are you kind to one another? Yeah. Well, how? Well, these ways. And then the Buddha has a follow-up question. He says, but do you remain heedful, ardent, and resolute? Basically, are you practicing hard? Or another way I'm hearing that is, are you clear on what you're doing, and are you staying engaged? Is right view alive? Heedful is like heedful of wholesome and unwholesome qualities, cultivating the wholesome, abandoning the unwholesome. Ardent, it's one of these words that shows up a lot in relationship to meditation, and resolute. So not only are you kind with one another, but are you practicing well? And then they say yes. Then there's a follow-up. I won't read the details of the follow-up, but when they're asked, oh, how are you abiding heedful, ardent, and resolute? They have this very interesting, coordinated, detailed way of all doing the chores. And what's relevant about that is that you could like switch out every task that they talk about with whoever or whichever. So there's this way that they can do it without talking even. One of the things is whoever sees that this particular jug of water needs filling, whoever sees it will do it. But if they deem that it's too heavy for them, they'll gesture over to someone else without speaking. Quote, so we do not break out into speech. They're so protecting the meditative mind that they've found ways to take care of their daily needs without the disturbance. Make sense? And then because they're really intense, or that's just me making light, every 5 days they stay up all night talking about the Dharma. And that's the talk that they do. Otherwise, they're abiding in seclusion, together in harmony. It's pretty amazing. And I think these two stories are put together in the Mahavagga and the Vinaya, in part because they're such stark examples of conflict and harmony. The latter being a really good example of good friendship, good Dharma friendship, as indicated by its power to help us cultivate the Eightfold Path. With the last couple of minutes, you need to know how the other story ends. The quarrel at Kosambi ends. The way this goes, the lay people in Kosambi get really frustrated with the quarreling monks, and they say more or less, it's on account of you that the Buddha went away, frustrated. So we as a lay community, who the monastics depend upon completely, they decide, the lay community decides unanimously that they're not going to pay respects to the monks and they're not going to feed them. So that gets some serious attention. And then the quarreling monks, decide, we need to go settle this with the Buddha. So interestingly, before the Buddha came to them, and now they are going back to the Buddha. And while this is happening, the offending monk, I'm so happy for him. He reflected again, apparently. He's reflecting on the Dharma, and he goes, that was an offense. But he doesn't, this is an inspiring point. He then does not hide it. He goes to his partisans, his allies, says, hey, this was a thing, will you help me? And then they go to the Buddha, and then you see where it goes from there. Domino effect. He apologized. He confessed. He laid it open to the community, and then they did their community transactions because the lay people withheld food. As one condition. Yeah, so with the last couple of minutes before we have some conversation. You know, I was out walking here before the talk today, admiring the light and the magnolias and the... God, there's so many beautiful plants. I live in San Francisco. And the thought occurred to me while I was walking that, sure, we have a really stark set of examples here of like the quarrel at Kosambi and then this like really coordinated, beautiful friendship of these three monks. And I thought, sure, the power of story is that you can enter into the perspective of any one of these characters and see it from their life. So what's it like to step in the form of the Buddha and be frustrated at these people who are fighting? I imagine parents have this some experience like that. Or what's it like to be the folks in the quarrel in Kosambi that they're actually right, and this other monk is just really being stubborn about the fact that... Or what's it like, maybe the hardest is like, what's it like to be the monk who really believes that he didn't do anything wrong, but everyone in the group is saying, yeah, you know, this is an offense. So anyway, I think there's some complexity to move around in there. But also relevant is the fact that I think for most of us living these modern lay lives, it's never that clean. It's never just like, I've got two friends and we live in perfect harmony together. And it's never like the quarrel at Kosambi, you know, where obviously there's some misguided action going on. It's just never that clean. So I think that's where our practice of ongoing ethical reflection is just so necessary. And as we learn from that experience, and then as our practice keeps maturing, as our right view, I'm going to say, purifies, then our ethical sensitivity gets more and more clear. And then we implement that new understanding and that new understanding. But I don't think we're going to meet with simple scenarios. So we'll have to stay attentive, I think. So thank you very much. One little bit of encouragement from monastic life, Zen monastic life at least, we have this teaching that the rocks and the rock tumbler polish one another. They're like, we bang into each other and have difficulty and tensions, but we all come out a little more smooth and a little more shined. That may well be so. I hope we can do that in a way that's peaceful. Peaceful enough and supportive of your practice. So now maybe if there are comments, questions, sharings.
Kodo-san, just maybe for clarification, could you tell people what the Vinaya is?
Oh, sure, thanks. Yeah. The Vinaya is the monastic rules that the monastics live by. And there are all these great stories in there. I thought it was just a list of rules, but there are origin stories for everything, every rule that came down. So there's a lot of good literature in there.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking.
Hi, thank you for your story. So I had two thoughts. So one was these monks, they dedicated their lives in like higher spirituality, and if they had quarrels and they couldn't get over, I was thinking, how am I supposed to live in harmonious when I just meditate like 10 minutes a day? So that was kind of one thought I had. And then the other one is, so I would like to live in harmony with all my friends and family, but like sometimes I feel like I need to have a boundary with certain people, otherwise I would feel like I get kind of taken advantage of or could be viewed as like pushover a little bit, like if I'm constantly generous and people don't appreciate my generosity or take it as like granted. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with those situations? Because if I kind of stop being generous and they protest and want to argue, like how, like what's the wise way to navigate something like that?
Great. Thank you for bringing these up. So it was, I heard a little edge, maybe this is a little farther than you meant, but like, if these monks practice so hard, how is harmony possible for me? And then specifically, when it's time for boundaries. Yeah. Thank you for both of those. Maybe I'll start with the second one first. And I had two things come to my mind to share. One is this overarching principle in Dharma practice and Buddhist practice of non-harming. And that in the umbrella of non-harming, it's not just every other being minus me. We're included too. So there are all number of really helpful teachings on wise speech, wise action, the 10 skillful actions. Those are just titles of lists, but things you can find that can be sort of food for our reflection about how to, even just things to try out in terms of how to live skillfully with others, especially when it comes to boundaries. In living harmonious with others, it's difficult to overestimate the power of right speech. Practicing right speech that's true, honest, useful, not harmful. There's a lot of freedom to be had there. In addition to speech, there's a teaching that I didn't give tonight, but I thought really hard about because it's so functional. There's a there's a sort of rubric that the Buddha gives to his son Rahula for considering an action. And in this very clear, direct way, he gives Rahula this way of thinking before, during, and after acting. This time, does it look like I'm going to cause harm, or does it look like I'm going to cause well-being? Okay, so my reflection says well-being. I'm going to go for it. And then you reflect while you're acting. So pointing toward harm, pointing toward well-being. Okay, still looks good. And then after looking, you look back and do the same thing. If you happen to have gone astray and harmed someone, then you can share that with a Dharma friend and resolve on something else in the future. I'm describing it just at that rubric level because it has such broad applicability. And it has this advantage where we are teaching ourselves how to live in a skillful way. So it doesn't offer a prescription at all about how do I live in this harmoniously in this world. It's more like through this iterative reflective process, we come to see what actually works in our own life. And then you can take these sets of teachings and try some of them out. Yeah. Thanks for your question. Yeah.
Thank you. I was thinking about the different types of conflict and like conflict I'll have with the family or friends or coworkers, and then I was thinking, well, what about myself here? Sometimes I'm my own worst critic, and I was thinking, oh, we practice loving kindness. I should probably do a little bit more of that with myself or something.
But nice.
Yeah, I was thinking of the conflict and how it was with the other members and the tribe or whatnot. And yeah, sometimes I think, well, we always have conflict with ourselves. It's hard to not have a day or something without that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I think that's highly relatable.
So in the story, as told, I'll call it a third party came in with a nuclear option and said, well, we're going to solve this problem.
Uh-huh.
Even the Buddha couldn't solve the problem.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's great to think that we'll always have somebody that can come in with such a severe consequence. We won't feed you if you don't shape up and fly right. So
how
do we get to a point where we can catalyze a change in the community without, you know, causing such a strong uproar, if you will?
Yeah, wow. That's a great question. A couple of things that come to my mind. I think one of the principles that keeps communities healthy is having a healthy rate of change. So having this what you called the nuclear option. I'm glad that wasn't the first thing. You know, I think the monks had to be ready, and they weren't yet ready. Before the lay folks did what they did. There's a really interesting teaching in this book that relates to this. When it's on the individual level, and then we can say something about community level. On the individual level, you may notice that someone is doing harm. There's this set of considerations. One is like, if I say something, will that be difficult for me? If I say something, will that hurt them because they're prone to anger and resentment? And there's some other ones in there, but the most important one is it possible for them to hear the message and change? And if it's not, then the other two don't matter. Interestingly, the Buddha goes through this and says it may be difficult for me, or it might not be difficult for me. That's not the criteria that rules out action. And same thing, they may be upset or not upset. Really, is there a possibility for change? In the community sense, this is just me speaking from my experience, from the time living in Dharma communities. I'm kind of surprised. One way or another, something is going to happen with any given situation. There's one way of considering this quarrel at Kosambi, not as the, you know, you could read it as like a failure of the Buddha or something, but I kind of see it as like the ecology just took its time, and soon enough, because there's this will to unity, something came together. It's maybe a little naive on my part. I guess I'm only going to take it as far as saying I've been surprised. I've been surprised in my own communities the level of distress or conflict that somehow has been able to resolve in an unexpected way. Yeah. And that gives me some hope. That's all I have at the moment, though. Yes.
Yeah, hi. Two things. I think there's a story in the Middle Length Discourses about a man who comes to the Buddha and just hurls insults at him.
Oh, yeah.
He wants to have teaching, and he just lets him know what a bunch of malarkey you're giving us, you know? And the Buddha says, you know, if somebody comes to your house and you feed them, are you polite to them, and or something like that? I don't quite remember it. But if they don't accept what you have to offer them, you know, I went too far afield because I can't remember the story perfectly, but the end result was that the Buddha basically says you can't teach someone who doesn't want to be taught. Even the Buddha can't teach someone who doesn't want to be taught.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
So whether we follow the Vinaya or not, whether we follow all the code, is really up to us. And I find it charming that these monks were quarreling so much that they basically screwed themselves out of their own, you know, ability to get food and continue their life. And that's what we do.
Hmm.
We quarrel that much, and we push something to an ultimate limit. And I think that that's kind of cool to know that the monks are just like us.
So. There they are. Someone recently quoted, I think, Jiyu Kennett to me, said, "You won't find saints in the monastery because saints don't need monasteries." I don't know if I'll take it that far. There's some pretty inspiring monastics.
Hopefully we have time for one last question.
Great.
Thank you, first of all, for your teaching. It's very, it's a beautiful gift. What struck me was this thing about, is somebody willing to learn, or is somebody willing to listen? And I'm in a situation now with my supervisor, and there's a way in which I go, well, he just isn't listening.
Oh, yeah.
So, is there an element of faith that, or trust that continuing a dialogue that doesn't seem to be going anywhere may actually lead somewhere? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, I don't really know whether they're willing, I don't really know whether they're willing to learn from what I have to say.
Sure.
I guess I can ask the question, am I willing to learn from what they have to say?
That's valid.
And that I have some sensory, some felt sense of whether am I willing to learn. But in terms of being able to evaluate, is this other person willing to learn from me? So do you have anything that you might want to say about that?
What's arising is a curiosity. I don't think it's not a solution. It's a two-pronged question. It's one is Are you clear about what you would want to say? And the second is, it's just like the question you asked. Like, am I willing to listen? Is there anything here that you're not seeing? There may not be. You may have a really clear lay of the land. And the third thing is a kind of like a wild hair curiosity. Like, is there something surprising that you can do in terms of communication? I'm not advising this thing I'm about to say, but this teacher of mine told me a story of she studied as a psychologist and was learning about brief therapy. And there was this intervention where there was a couple who was having a fight just every day, fight, same fight every day. They'd get home and have the same fight. And their therapist was like, okay, I want you to go home tonight. I want you to have the exact same fight you always have, but I want you to do it in the bathtub. And something about that broke the spell, and then a dialogue could open. So it's not a direct path. But I do wonder if there's some like quantum shift that's available through a surprise. Maybe give this person a gift or something. Or something less drastic.
Thank you.
I think we've come to time. I very much enjoyed the evening with you. Talking about quarrels and harmony. Why don't we end with a dedication? So may it be that our endeavor in the Dharma and our reflective life is conducive to harmony for us, for others, can be an inspiring light for ourselves and for others. And may all beings everywhere be happy, peaceful, and free. Very nice to be with all of you.